I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast. I'm news correspondent Sarah King. I'm joined in studio for the first time in 3 weeks altogether by Gavin Riley and Richard Chambers.
Hello.
Welcome back, everybody.
What an auspicious day. We're all back.
Good thing very little has changed since the last time we were all here together, isn't it?
I know. A week is a long time in politics, and we are a full week on since Leo Varadkar made that shock announcement. Sorry, Richard, I was laughing. So obviously, Gavin and I did the podcast on the hoof outside Leinster House last week. I got at least four DMs from people being like, poor Richard is cracking in Rome.
Actually wasn't.
I know, yeah. I
not in any possible way. I mean, I did watch Leo Varadkar's, or some of Leo Varadkar's speech in the Coliseum.
Yes.
Wow.
What a place
what
to
a
be.
What a place.
Where were you when Leo made the announcement? The Coliseum.
Some American tourist who was also on that tour, which was great, by the way. Hadn't been in a few years. And he was like, here you guys are getting a new Taoiseach. And I was like, where did you pick this up?
Wow.
Must have been the BBC push alert or something.
Good pronunciation, though. Well done, that American.
Yeah, he was a worldly man. Mm. And he was very interested in hearing about who the next guy might be.
Did he have any opinions as to whether Leo Varadkar was in fact running away ahead of a scandal, or whether he was just fatigued by 7 years of running the country?
No, he was like, what the hell? What the hell's happening there? So yeah, there you go.
We didn't get your take on how shocked you were. Were you shocked?
I think everybody is becoming wise to the Leo Varadkar having a limited time frame in his premiership. Effectively, you know, everybody's become wise to that after the fact now. But it was a shock, obviously, when you do see these things unfolding. First of all, you know, you're getting WhatsApp messages unsolicited from people who are saying, "Did you hear the news about Leo and what's going to happen there?" And I was like, what? What's going on here? I was like, it was 22 degrees in Rome. I was just like, I was having a lovely time.
You were on vacation.
Yeah. And I was just like, oh, for God's sake.
So that's it. If you're in the middle of the tour when you were watching the speech, were you then lined up ready for admission to the tour when you started getting the push alerts?
No, see, it was one of those tours. This is a complete tangent already. So it was a tour of the Roman Forum and Palatine Hill and then the Colosseum.
Okay.
So you walked. So it all broke. Well, it was pre-broke because everybody knew what it was then before the speech was made.
So
that was in the forum then,
so
which is amazing.
Forum, where you talked through the chariot teams that were themed after the Four Seasons or whatever, and then you're getting the push alerts being like, political earthquake.
You're looking at the triumphant arches, you're looking at the Temple of the Vestal Virgins and all that sort of stuff, and then you're walking around through the metal detectors of the Colosseum, and then the world changed back home all the while. So yeah.
So fantastic.
Good times.
You were straight off the plane and home to find out who might be Leo's successor, which was a short-lived...
That was in many ways, like, from a self-interested journalistic point of view, it is a bit of a damn squib to have no leadership competition whatsoever and have it all settled almost immediately on the day that Leo Varadkar announced that he was going to be standing down. So breakneck speed there. There is a little bit of there's some interesting, like, sort of little background tidbits around that whole the Simon Harris coronation, you know, the immediacy of all of that and whose nose is out of joint as a result of all of that, which I'm quite interested in.
Let's get stuck into it.
Well, I just will say, just when we're on the topic of self-interest, I'm thrilled there isn't a Fine Gael contest.
Because you're on holidays this week.
Yeah. Here I am in a suit in work on holidays.
Thank you for coming in. I'm off
diary. This is my casual suit. This
you look really rested, by the way. You look great. Are you enjoying your time off?
Because my kids are sleeping, which is great.
Oh, so brilliant.
But had there been a Fine Gael contest, I'd have been on the road this week and probably a lot of next week as well. So very self-interested.
I did love your wife's post. It was like Fine Gael ruining my Easter, ruining my school holidays since, you know, whatever. It was very
since
funny.
2024.
Sorry,
where were we?
The nose is at a joint. I mean, like, it's funny because we had a conversation here, didn't we, on the podcast a couple of months ago where we talked about, you know, hypothetically who would become the next leader of Fine Gael. And we did talk about Simon Harris in the mix, but he wasn't the obvious, really, front runner at the time. And then all of a sudden when things actually happened, it was very rapid fire that he became, like, I loved that Gavin straight in with the spreadsheet the next morning.
Oh, with a very short list.
Very unnecessary spreadsheet.
I actually did monitor your spreadsheet for a few hours.
Well, it was a handy way just to figure out who had actually declared it. When we thought it might be, well, here, the following votes are tallied up for Pascal Donoghue, and it turned out to not really be the case. Because when we did our poll on the hoof a week ago, And there was a point in which you were outlining the possible contenders and you named all five.
Like all of them.
Of the other ministers in cabinet. And I think what happened ultimately, first of all, it's worth remembering that Simon Harris managed Simon Coveney's campaign 7 years ago. So Simon Harris was at the front line when he saw Leo Varadkar's choreographed drip feed of endorsements and how that kind of irrevocably changed some of the momentum of the contest. So he obviously learned from the lessons of 2017. But I think behind the scenes, what was happening is when we were doing our pod on the hoof, there was this presumption that, a bit like a swan, you know, above the surface, it's a case of everyone is observing almost the institutional day of mourning within Fine Gael. We don't talk about replacing the leader when we've just found out that the leader is gone. But actually, you know, below deck, the flippers are paddling furiously and Simon Harris is figuring out how all the endorsements are going to be choreographed the next morning. So that if you're Pascal Donoghue and you're waking up on Thursday and you're saying, right, time to get our boots on and see if there's a campaign here. Actually, someone else has like a 12-hour head start. And by the time you're getting going, there's already half a dozen endorsements. Yeah. And it just creates this irresistible momentum. Like,
It was Neil Richmond was the first minister, I think, to come out and support.
Yeah, he was on Morning
Ireland. Barry Ward.
He was pre-booked to go on.
We're both hanging out with him and are very close to him ever since. So, I mean, you would wonder, are they anticipating a nice gig in the new
Because there will have to be at least one promotion, because obviously Leo Varadkar himself will not be among the six of cabinet grade. Which actually brings us to the side point of whether any of the retiring 10, the 10 Fine Gael TDs who have already announced they're not going to run next time around. If you think about it, there is good reason for any of them to just U-turn and say, let's take a gig. Because there are six of cabinet level, including Simon Harris himself, and 8 junior ministries to go around. So that's 14. You have 33 TDs to choose from, 10 of whom have already announced they're not running next time. One of whom is Leo Varadkar, so you can't give him a ministry when he's just stood down. And there's a few other figures, that the likes of Alan Dillon, who is right now the party chairman. Basically, if you're not running again in 12 months' time, you can't expect to be given like a ministerial bauble, which, you know, amplifies your chances of re-election. So you're almost getting into the territory where ministers have to get chosen by default. If you've only got 22 people to choose from, and you've got 14 jobs to hang around. Basically, by announcing that you're U-turning and coming out of retirement, if you are hypothetically the likes of a Brendan Griffin, although we understand he's made his mind up, he's leaving. But if you're a Brendan Griffin or a John Paul Phelan, and you turn around and say, actually, you know what, change my mind, I want to run again, there's an immediate chance you get handed a junior ministry, which is a bizarre place to be in. But that's how few TDs there are and how many jobs there are to go around.
Interesting. What did you make of it? I know you said you were the background antics. Come on, talk to us. You've got thoughts.
Well, like, no, it's interesting because the way that the Harris the outpouring of support was choreographed, if you want to put it that way.
The outpouring.
Of people were the impulse came over people to just ring up radio stations and tell them how much they love Simon Harris and how he was the right man to lead the party.
I did hear Claire Byrne at one point say to somebody, okay, you've said you like him, you've said enough about him.
I mean, you have to understand this isn't a cynical thing. Like this, nothing happens by accident. People just don't. Do you know what? I'm just going to stick my neck out and ring about and say I love Simon Harris. He's great. He should be the next leader of the party. This is all part of a plan. You roll out a showcase of support. The people whose noses are out of joint. It was interesting to read some of the coverage over the weekend, gone about how some people believe that Pascal Donoghue was betrayed by Leo Varadkar. In that Leo Varadkar didn't give him a heads up, given how closely Pascal Donoghue and Leo Varadkar's political fortunes have been intertwined, how much Pascal Donoghue was crucial, I think, to Leo Varadkar becoming the Fine Gael leader back when he launched his campaign for it 7 years ago.
On Leo Street.
Yeah, on Leo Street, all the buns and all that sort of stuff. But just generally, just been very, very close political colleagues and comrades over the years. And some people in Fine Gael were thinking, the only way there was ever going to be a campaign was if Leo did give someone a tip on the shoulder and say the night before, here, look, I'm jumping out of this job. You might want to get your ducks in a row.
Which he did to Simon Coveney, not to anyone else. Yeah,
exactly. So the amount of groundwork that Simon Harris has put in over the years, and we've all sort of, almost in a joking way, talked about it for a long while, that Simon Harris has, since he was in short pants, eyed up the Taoiseach's office in government buildings and, you know, had been sizing up what portraits he'd hang on the walls and whatnot. And he finally got it, probably sooner than he would have thought.
I would say it was a lot sooner than he expected.
I mean, I do wonder about the psychology of some of these high up politicians and people who are like in politics for life, like a Simon Harris. Whether this was in his, like, if he charted out his ideal course to the Taoiseach's office, whether he did see himself in his 30s becoming the Taoiseach. He probably did in some degree. Like, you have to weigh up how highly politicians think of themselves.
I remember seeing Simon
Harris. Not in a negative way.
Like, when I think back to, like, I was working in news, we were all on News Talk to FM at the time, like 10 years ago, and I was covering the European elections for Ireland South in the Nemo Rangers Count Centre in Cork, which would be coming up on 10 years ago now this year. And I remember seeing Simon Harris in the Count Centre that time. And, like, even the way he operated with people, and, you know, he's a very personable person. He's definitely, his communication skills have been praised. But I remember seeing him 10 years ago, and I was a young journalist at the time and thinking, that guy is like, he's aiming
for
the top.
He ran.
He ran.
He was. He was basically drafted in late into it.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was almost by accident he almost became an MEP.
Yeah, but he was like the sweeper on the eastern half of the constituency, picking up votes that would transfer back to Deirdre Clune and Sean Kelly.
Yeah.
Do you remember, I think there was something years ago, this was in the very early years of his political career, he was on some radio show or something with Eamon Dunphy. And Gay Byrne went on the radio then days later extolling her virtues and saying, this guy is great. He's the new Gareth Fitzgerald and all that sort of stuff. So, like, he always had...
potential.
The potential was there from a Fine Gael perspective there for this guy. But I think it's kind of I don't know if it's been lost, but it can be kind of unnoticed, I think, by the general population that Simon Harris, despite having this wave of support from everybody publicly in Fine Gael, a lot of people in Fine Gael aren't happy with him. A lot of people don't think, like, if you go back even over the last couple of years since the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about how Simon Harris had been plotting away in the background for this very moment, for the moment when he could unseat Leo Varadkar. Now, Leo Varadkar unseated himself in the end. But there was a lot of talk about, there's a lot of disloyalty there. This guy's driving around, he's picking up the phone, he's sort of marshalling support for the day that it comes. And remember, he wasn't actually a very popular man in the coalition, all told as well. After he left the health portfolio, there was a lot of talk about disloyalty. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that. And this isn't the first time anybody's spoken about this, but maybe it is since, you know, he became leader. Because, you know, people do move on from these things. But this stuff was printed out. There was a lot of feeling and there was a lot of, you know, behind the scenes, probably a little bit of, well, Simon Harris has been moved out of health, but it seemed like all he wanted was to be back in health and be back in the spotlight. And of course, when he became the temporary justice minister, he seized on that.
Yeah.
He was all over that job.
Into that.
Yeah. Very visible.
Yeah.
And I suppose that drew the contrast between himself and Helen McEntee, who would have been a royal.
That actually reminds me, I'd actually kind of forgotten to a little degree how whenever he was doing media in the first 12 months after the new government was formed, and he was ostensibly there to talk about further and higher education, but a Claire Byrne or a Matt Cooper or an Ivan Yates says, by the way, what do you think about the latest NPHET advice? And he'd sound off about it because it was the question he's asked, but he would have no hesitancy in commentating on the COVID policy.
But a lot of us as journalists, when you got a chance to catch Simon Harris, you were still asking him health questions because the health story was still the top story at the time as well. Like, so there was an element of that there too.
But there would be some who would say, you know what, it's not my brief, but the government says this.
I know, he was more than happy.
Simon was happy.
He was more than happy. He'd even say that himself as well.
No, he would. But I think as well, like, it's important to remember, like, you know, what triggered the last election was that vote of no confidence in Simon Harris. I remember during the last general election and we were looking at it and Simon Harris wasn't visible in any of Fine Gael's sort of, you know, big photo calls, big kind of election campaigning at that time. You know, Simon Harris had kind of been hidden away a little bit.
Well, you were following
and it was, but it was the pandemic and it was having to sort of stay in that health portfolio that, you know, in many ways sort of rebooted Simon Harris's career in some ways and his image as someone who had leadership qualities.
But despite all that and despite the fact that he was, his career was resurrected effectively by the pandemic, and then he went away to what is seen politically as a cushy enough portfolio where you're not, you know, creating any great harm in higher education. But I was speaking to one rural Fine Gael TD there the other day on the day I came back, and I was like, well, what do you think about Harris, and is this going to be a coronation and all that? And he's like, I think it'll be the biggest mistake we make. He's just Leo all over again. And he made reference to, I think it was, I didn't hear this interview now. Maybe it was Neil Richmond on the radio that morning. And he said that, did he refer to Simon Harris as being part of a rural constituency or whatever? There was somebody said something about that. Somebody alluded to this.
Know.
This may not have actually happened. But this TD was exercised by this fact that this Wicklow TD was being referred to as being part of as a rural constituency. But basically,
well, I mean, there are rural parts of it, but he's from Greystones.
Exactly. So, Dublin. It's a commuter town just outside Dublin. But the fact of the matter is, there are people in the grassroots who are concerned that Simon Harris is a repetition of the same mistakes of Leo Varadkar. And there's been a lot of coverage over the last week or so about the TikTok Taoiseach, which is actually hard to say.
I prefer TikTok.
I find that TikTok. Real. But, like, what do you think about it, Zara?
What's wrong with that, though? Let's just hash that out for a second, because what's wrong with being contactable and connected with the younger
I think it's overstated how good he is at it. I think it's well overstated.
But see, I'm going to be honest, I'm not on TikTok. I have a TikTok account. I don't look at TikTok on a regular basis. I use Instagram mainly. But I would say if you look at his Instagram account and you look at the engagement, like he does have high viewer numbers.
Yeah,
and
he does
have high engagement. And like much higher than a lot of other politicians who aren't in the same.
I remember asking one Fine Gael TD last Wednesday evening if they thought there would be a contest, or if they were having that conversation around whether a contest would be good for the party, because even though Simon Harris might have been preordained as a winner, would it be good for the party to really kind of have to figure out what it stands for, rather than Simon Harris now going on basically what amounts to a listening tour uncontested.
So that would be like 2 weeks of navel gazing.
Yeah, so but they said, and dominating the media agenda, which Fine Gael would consider been, yeah, useful. This TD said they had been at a college campus a few months previously, and basically a few other people were knocking around, and there was sort of no great shakes, and then Simon Harris showed up. And whether it was because of the fact that he was the Minister for Higher Education, which makes him the minister responsible for giving you €1,000 of your registration fee back for the last couple of years for the student contribution charge, or he's the minister for grants, or whether he was the guy that was on Instagram asking you to be careful during the pandemic. There was a breakthrough there that they thought superficially, if Sinn Féin have the youth vote tied up, the only possible way we have of bursting that bubble is by somebody who has that level of facial recognition that Simon Harris did among younger people. Whether that is a very meaningful metric, I don't know.
Well, I think
it's one thing they immediately
see. Yeah, but arguably I would say that that's not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like, I think sometimes some people are a bit dismissive, or maybe they're like, oh, you know, big deal, like he's great on social media. Like, that is actually a big factor going forward when you're trying to communicate with young voters.
Well, I don't think the coverage is, any of the coverage from, you know, people who are describing it as the TikTok Taoiseach, I don't think it's seen as a negative thing. Like, people are painting it as Fine Gael saying, this man has magical powers to speak to younger people. Like, I mean, sure, he knows the platforms, but do you think that the young people of Ireland currently in the middle of a housing crisis and what they're seeing from Simon Harris is convincing them to vote for Fine Gael? The polls would say that they're not. Maybe that'll change. Maybe his communication skills, which are quite good, maybe that will change things. But I do think that there's an element of the same justification being used by Fine Gael in going for Simon Harris that they would have used for Leo Varadkar, and that they saw him as this really good communicator. Mm-hmm. This guy is good. Let's tie ourselves to him. So I don't know if that brings everybody along with them. That's not how our politics really does work here.
There is one view of Simon Harris among those in other coalition parties that speak on the communications piece, that whether he is particularly gifted at the communications piece or not, the perception they have is that he spends more time communicating than doing. That particularly in his time in health, and when it came to the pandemic, but the nature of the job was that you had to spend your time communicating, because actually the delivery of health stuff was kind of being done by the HSE, and there wasn't so much that a minister could do other than the communications piece. But that they perceive him as somebody who spends a lot of time talking about the things he's doing and not necessarily doing as much. I mean, there was one that quip last week that he's announced the same student beds three times now, that there's a perception that Simon Harris's gift is to continually repackage stuff that's already there, but not move heaven and earth in actually doing it. And people thought that was the case with health as well. I know some of the independent TDs last time around thought that he was great at being the face of stuff, but when it came to actually doing the heavy lifting of materially changing health policy and health
structure. Undoubtedly that is going to be his single biggest challenge, is, you know, putting your money where your mouth is. Like, you know what I mean? It's like when people say, you know, it's great to be on the opposition benches and be able to say, well, if we were there, we would do this and we would do that. It's not a million miles off that. You know, being Simon Harris and being, you know, sort of, as I say, like the cool, popular minister, you know, it's going to be very different when you have to make tougher decisions at the top and actually implementing real change. And he really doesn't have that much time left to do it.
No.
You know, the opposition are calling for a general election now. They want it now. Obviously, it's not going to happen now. But, you know, he's got very little time to sort of turn it around. And particularly when it comes to housing, where, you know, it takes time to build houses. You know, I don't know if he's really going to manage to steer that large ship around.
He's got 12 months, which basically means he's got 9 months, because after you break for Christmas, like legislation wise, the doll's back for about a week or two weeks before you have to dissolve it for an election anyway. So he's got 9 months to do stuff.
On the TikTok and the communications and social media and the young people thing, I think it's very noteworthy that the biggest Simon Harris content I've seen since he was, you know, effectively become the Fine Gael party leader are memes of, for anybody who thinks this party is tired, is out of energy, he ain't seen nothing yet.
He kind of looked a bit tired himself when he said that.
Did he look immediately bashful about saying it? Did he realise how corny the line was?
I don't know, but like, I mean, people are, is it a good thing if people are memeing your speeches and your comments? Probably a mixed bag, I would imagine.
Well, at least people are seeing it, I suppose, Gavin. Well,
yeah.
One point actually I want to actually ask your opinions on, because I was listening to the radio there the other day and John Lee of the Mail was on. He was speaking about Leo Varadkar because he's obviously the other person in all this. He was saying that there's a waste of potential, that his career promised so much but delivered so little. I think that's going to be an interesting one to see how people eventually evaluate the career of Leo Varadkar. Huge big moments throughout it, but whether or not he delivered on all the potential that he showed in his earlier years, that's another question, I think.
Now, many of us will have seen those shocking pictures from Baltimore in the United States where the Dolly container ship crashed into the bridge there. We can just take a look at this shot. It's unbelievable that this was a live feed that was running. Those of you listening obviously can't see that, but would have heard and seen it throughout the week. It's like to see it crumbling down like a piece of engineering like that is really, really shocking, isn't it?
I think it's very sobering to remember, aside from the level of human tragedy that there is, and obviously at the time we're recording this, there's still some of the construction workers that were on the bridge who are still unaccounted for, obviously in this very fluid and moving situation. But the degree to which you just start to expect that infrastructure like that is there and how much disruption will be caused by what appears to be just one just absolutely catastrophic accident, where if a ship loses power and is unable to control its own navigation and does that, that you now have a bridge which is part of the equivalent of their M50 around the city, which is now out of action, and the knock-on consequences that has for everyone else. So much of the port now being inaccessible because there will be debris from the bridge that's going to be on the seabed for a long time, which they're going to have to remove before a lot of the shipping traffic is able to start safely navigating that again. The level of disruption that there's going to be for years as a result of this, and how much you take for granted that the infrastructure is just going to work and be there, that I think that the disruption is going to be something else. And I also think it's actually just worth saying as well, when they're talking about there only being six construction workers that were unaccounted for at the time that we're recording this, how much greater the human loss might have been, but for the foresight to say, oh, there's a ship coming in that's issued a mayday because it's lost power. We better just stop civilian traffic just in case something goes wrong.
But amazing that they were able to do that even at 1:30 in the morning, that there was the resources to do that.
Yeah, and I don't know what the systems were like, were there just bridges, just barriers that come down to immediately say, you know, we better just restrict traffic here just on the off chance that something goes wrong, and how valuable that foresight was, because who knows what sort of traffic might have been lined up and how many civilians might have been driving or cycling or whatever at that hour of the morning even still. People whose lives would have been just completely turned upside down by that happening.
And
great they had that level of foresight.
Joe Biden has committed to giving the money to have that bridge rebuilt as quickly as possible. And just at the time of recording here on Wednesday afternoon, the latest is that investigators are now boarded the container ship and they're conducting their investigations there. But as I say, it's going to be a number of days, I suppose, before we have a clearer picture of what happened. I thought it was interesting. CNN had an investigations team working on it yesterday, and they had gone through dash cam footage, any sort of live streams, any sort of user generated footage, basically, and also being able to follow the ship navigation app to see sort of the path it took, and also then to see the lights going out just before the point of impact and everything. And I think it's interesting now to see that, you know, how investigations can be really clearly laid out based on user generated footage and things like live streams and user generated video. But it was interesting to see that, and as you say, Gavin, I think it was probably credit to people involved in saving lives that the bridge was actually closed just before the
You just remind me that use of user generated stuff. Do you remember we had that podcast is, by the way, we're 2 years old this week. I don't know if we've even remarked on our podcast's own birthday.
Happy birthday to us.
But in one of our first episodes, we had Malachy Brown on from the New York Times talking about how they try to use user-generated footage to try and fact-check certain things that happen in other more war-torn parts of the world. But you don't often hear it being talked about for Western countries for civilian catastrophes like this. And it's kind of interesting to see it being used in that circumstance.
One point was to see the US media making over the last couple of days, because obviously Joe Biden said, we're going to put in, you know, all the money that we can to rebuild and all that sort of stuff. And obviously there's an investigation to be done into this particular incident, but it has highlighted how poorly invested in American infrastructure can be. There has been reports, and I see USA Today putting it out there, that more than 42% of the more than 600,000 highway bridges are over 50 years old, and they're all designed for a lifespan of 50 years. So there's literally 222,000 bridge spans, and 76,000 bridges need some type of repair or complete replacement. The lack of investment in American infrastructure for, you know, what we all look at as the superpower of our world is really bad and they're in such a bad state of repair, it is fascinating to sort of see. So I think that's going to be a focus. Joe Biden has talked a lot about infrastructure and the need to rebuild America. I think it's just drawing that more and more into focus, I think.
Absolutely. Richard, immigration changes, what's happening here?
So obviously, immigration and asylum seeker accommodation have been, without question, I think, among the hot button issues politically over the last stretch of time. So two things were brought to cabinet today. One on the process of immigration, that's at an EU level, the EU Migration Pact. Effectively, what Helen McEntee, the Justice Minister, says is this is going to mean, you know, faster turnarounds. People who are coming here from what they're known as a secondary country. So basically, they've arrived into another part of the EU first, and then they've arrived into Ireland. Ireland sees that as a particular problem, seeing as they say, effectively, you should stay in the first country that you arrive into when you get into Europe. So more security, more screening in terms of fingerprinting, all that sort of stuff, and then quicker turnaround times as part of, this is an overarching European agreement. Everyone's going the same direction on this. So they believe that this is going to make things a lot faster in terms of processing people and returning them or deporting them if they are effectively found to, you know, not have a valid application for asylum here. The other thing is, obviously, on the accommodation side, the government has been talking up a long-term plan on accommodation for a long time. Roderick O'Gorman outlining that today, effectively a quadrupling of the beds available, trying to move away from the privatised system and the use of hotels. However, in the interim period, hotels are going to be hugely relied on. Now, one thing the government is doing, obviously we saw the outcome of this in Racket Hall in Roscrea, the D Hotel in Drogheda. The last hotel in the town is something which they're going to try and avoid using. That's a commitment they're going to try and make as part of this. So they're going to try and use state land to build modular units, for example, and to use disused or unused offices to try and accommodate people. Now, the two things with both of these plans, which have been put forward by the government, Simon Harris out today saying this is about a sustainable approach as opposed to an emergency response to migration and accommodation, is nobody expects this to take the heat out of this issue in the near future. This isn't going to change things immediately. These are both long-term things. It's going to take 2 years to get into the EU Migration Pact. Things like building modular accommodation units, all that, this is the long term. So the immigration as a political issue in the run-up to the next general election and into the local and Euros, not going away.
Particularly.
Going away whatsoever. And this is, you know, there's an acceptance around government buildings that while they think that these are going to be things long term to take the heat out of it, they're still up against it in terms of public sentiment.
They will have to be long term, because like how many times have we heard about modular housing for Ukrainian refugees in the last couple of years? I'm not even sure if any of them are actually online yet. If they have come online, but all these talks about OPW sites that they were going to build modular accommodation, even just for families. You're able to pull it up while we're talking about this. I don't remember there being any announcement about that opening or the first of them actually coming online. And they've been talking about it for, well, they've got to 2 years now, literally. So I'd like to know like how quickly they think they can introduce modular accommodation for like asylum seekers if they're struggling to build them for a very smaller number of Ukrainians. One thing which I think is interesting about the EU level things, there are some within Leinster House who are just opposed to this. Ireland has an opt-in to a lot of these justice things because historically speaking, as an island nation off the coast of continental Europe, a lot of the other countries, they by definition need to pool into these things. But because we're an island nation at the far end, we've always had the option to opt in or out of these things. And we're choosing to opt into the Migration Pact. And some TDs don't want us to do that because it means opting into the solidarity mechanism where you can decide either to have your pro rata number of asylum seekers or refugees assigned to you, or you can pay other countries to deal with the burden that they've got disproportionately. And they would say, well, you know, we already have a number that we're struggling to accommodate, so why should we feel the need to pay other countries? There's an argument for that. But on the flip side, many of the things that are included in this EU Migration Pact, like, for example, quicker turnarounds or slightly more aggressive approaches to those who have had asylum claims turned down and their removal from the country, they're part and parcel of this as well. And people who are criticising some aspects as being inappropriate for Ireland are actually overlooking some other parts which are in line with what they've been asking for a long time, but they're turning it down because it's European.
I think it's interesting, sorry, just going back to the point that you made about the use of obviously the modular housing, but then the office buildings. I suppose, look, it's you can see even in Dublin City Centre, there are some offices that are totally abandoned.
Tons of them, actually, yeah. Even like it does, new ones which aren't even finished yet.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like, that is an interesting point. It probably is a good use of properties that are like standing there with nothing in them and that are vacant. But I suppose, is the proposal then that long term you would have sort of essentially reception centres, and do people live in those centres until, you know, they get signed off to stay longer? Like, how, I don't, I'm a bit confused
which,
as
which
to what that actually
very
means.
Very like direct provision, really.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. What's the difference between that and direct provision?
I think other than the state-owned facilities, so that instead of using Mosney or some other purpose, like
you're
some other accommodation,
you're
using something which has been already taken over and commandeered by the state on a permanent basis, rather than paying some other private contractor for the long-term use of their hotel or their holiday camp or okay. whatever it is. But the system,
the truth is, direct provision is just awful and doesn't really work either. So, like, why are you know, is it not? Is this not an opportunity really to sort of look at the overall system and make it better?
The conclusion that you would draw is that this government, having come to power with an overwhelming public sympathy to get rid of direct provision, has now realised that the numbers arriving to the country seeking protection are so large that actually they can't do without it. And what they just need to do is formalise the state running of the system rather than paying outside contractors for the use of their facilities or for the use of their beds.
You researching away there over here?
Yeah, I was just on the point about the modular homes and how many of them have actually been used for Ukrainian refugees. But if three or four... times last year where they were open, there was Mahon in Cork. That one was, there was a bit
okay.
of a,
and that is open, and that's
Tullamore, Clare Morris as well, for families have all moved in.
Okay.
So there has been examples of it, but there have been numerous other examples where even planning permission and things like that, there has been objections and whatnot. So, you know, it doesn't matter how often the state can go around and find land to put things in. We've seen so many times as well, objections and protests whenever things are earmarked as well. So that is something which, you know, you might have best will in the world and all the plans long term to try and sort this out. Many, many hitches on the way there.
Something very briefly, because then we need to move on, but something I think we should come back to in future weeks is the complete mismatch of city centre properties and what they're used for versus what we actually need. That at some point, someone made a calculation that Dublin would need X amount of floor space for corporate offices. There is not the market for that anymore. There might be generations hence, but like, how did we get that mismatch so wrong? Or do we have so much surplus office accommodation and so few for places for people to actually live?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So Richard, Paris is investing in social housing, making it nice. And we're wondering, should Ireland be doing the same?
It's not even just the social housing element, although that is key to this, right? So Paris has basically seen what's happened around the world, and Paris is a notoriously expensive city, even when you compare it to, you know, similar sized cities like London, for example, like New York, San Francisco as well. What they have done, and what has been a big initiative from City Hall in Paris over the last number of years, has been to make sure that there's still a social mix of people who live there. And it actually goes directly off what Gavin was saying there about the fact that in Dublin, we decided that the city centre should be full of offices. And come hell or high water, everyone can commute in and come out wherever they want. They can spend, you know, hours in the train or in the car to get into the city centre, and that's where the offices are. What Paris has done is make sure that Parisians live in Paris, that there are good quality social housing there that's available, that they keep the social mix so that it doesn't become a London situation where we've seen over the last number of years, the city centre there, all of the wealthy parts of London are effectively the playthings of Russian and Saudi, you know, playboys who just buy up massive buildings, live there and, you know, have their supercars in the driveway, all that sort of stuff. What they've done is to try and buy old buildings. This is all sounds very familiar in terms of what we should be doing in this country and what people have argued we should be doing in this country. Buy old buildings like old police barracks from the 18th century, do them up very nicely as social housing. And people are very, very proud across party levels in France, not even on a conservative or liberal basis. They're very happy with this because it keeps the social mix. But the other element is as well, it's not just on the housing element, it's on how buildings are used in the city centre. So one of the complaints you see around Dublin, and particularly around O'Connell Street, is what O'Connell Street, which is a grand boulevard in the Parisian sense, in terms of its design, you know, lovely tree lined, all that sort of stuff. The problem is the shop fronts. You have all the chain stores and shop fronts and mobile phone shops.
I just saw the other day that Cleary's is now H&M. Is that a long time ago? I only noticed it.
It's only just reopened in the last week or two, I think.
But yeah.
Oh, yeah, I just noticed
Cleary's,
that.
Cleary's quarter, they're calling it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right.
Must everything be a quarter?
I know, I'm big against that from developers as well. But one of the things Paris is doing, so City Hall decides commercial land holdings. They say, I never did French, so I don't know. Nicolas Bonnet-Oulage says, we don't rent to McDonald's, we don't rent to Burger King, we don't rent to Sephora. The importance and the quality of shop fronts and the preservation of French businesses like boulangeries, all that sort of stuff, authentic, independent traders, hardware shops, mom and pop stores, as they're commonly known by the David Williamses of this world, that they're preserved in the neighbourhoods and the city centre, so that there is an authentic feel, that it doesn't just become a cookie cutter sort of city centre with garish shop front and all that sort of stuff, and that people are happy and proud to live in.
I'm sure at one point I remember there being an official policy for that for O'Connell Street, where they said, okay, we know we've already got a couple of Burger Kings or an Eddie Rockets or a McDonald's or whatever, but then in future, basically, we're not going to let that happen. But then you go to the Parnell Street end of O'Connell Street, and actually there are a couple of more fast food or other restaurant outlets down there.
Yeah, but I suppose arguably as well, if you're a big European city, you kind of do need the investment of those big, you know, chain stores. You need the H&Ms to draw crowds. You probably do need a certain amount of that.
You'd probably rather have H&M there than a grand retail unit sitting there derelict, unused.
That, which, like, if Cleary's has been for how many years now? When did the Cleary stuff happen?
It's
a long time ago.
It's certainly a few years, I guess, since that kind of corporate machinations. Yeah,
it was.
But there is a point that there's the northern end of the street has been kind of broadly derelict because the old Carlton Hotel or the old cinema that was down there has basically been allowed to fall into ruin. There's been the long-standing plans about redeveloping Moore Street and what you're going to do then with the top end of O'Connell Street, because it's all sort of interrelated, and that part of town has been kind of allowed to slide a little bit. And there is that debate of, would you rather have it busy with chain stores, or would you rather try and regenerate it with something that's sort of naturally authentic?
Like, it's very interesting when you talk about, you know, people living in the city centre and we have all these empty offices, and like, people have talked so much about how they don't feel safe walking around Dublin because it's, you know, it is kind of empty after a certain time in the evening.
Or even at weekends as
it
well.
It is kind
if you're
of
in
like
corporate
no one talks
sort of
about
Dublin.
That.
Like, it's just empty offices, it's shell
Grand Canal Dock.
There are certain roads in Dublin that you, like, the city centre will be packed and the usual places will be packed, and then you'll drive home sort of out of town, and there are, like, you know, I'm thinking of, like, even like around Mount Street and stuff, it can be very, very quiet at the weekends. But like, it's interesting that, you know, in France, the idea of the suburbs, the banlieue, like, that's not a good thing, that it's, you know, it can be, you know, somewhat sort of, you know, dodgy neighbourhood where people don't feel safe walking around. Whereas I think, you know, if you flip it the other way, people feel unsafe walking around the city centre here. So I wonder, is it an interesting strategy in terms of making places safe? Do you make them places where people live and they have pride of place in them and that there's community in them?
There's one other subtext to all of that, which is that I don't know whether she's still the mayor or not, but the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, was responsible for the idea of 15-minute cities, which is something which has been...
What's a 15-minute city?
The idea that you should live within 15 minutes commute from all of the things that you might need, whether it's schools or workplaces or supermarkets or all of the other civic amenities. And in the last 4 years, that idea has been commandeered by some to imply climate-related lockdowns.
You won't be allowed to leave 15 minutes out of your city, is the conspiracy theory. Everything within a 15-minute convenient window.
And those ideas come one and the same.
Director Dan tells me the Cleary's closed down in 2015. I was thinking that's nearly 10 years.
Long time, yeah.
I remember covering that at the time.
Yeah. But 15-minute cities is inherent to this idea of there being a social mix, or making sure that there are parts of town that people live in, so that you shouldn't have districts that are entirely commercial or entirely industrial, that there should be a certain amount of people being able to live within that.
Yeah.
And part of the idea is, well, then you should have interspersed living and interspersed business premises, and they should all be kind of one and the same, which is something we've never really mastered here, but something which would probably be taken on as having some sort of ill intent were it to be pursued too much.
Which is unfortunate, because I think it would be quite nice to live in the centre of town and have a nice life. Since we recorded last week, was it the day we recorded or the day after we heard from the Princess of Wales?
That was last Friday.
It was Friday. It was Friday. So as people will know by now, Kate Middleton has announced that she is undergoing treatment for cancer. And it obviously brings to an end the speculation of where is Kate and what's happening. The reason I wanted to talk about it, I suppose, obviously, because we did cover it ourselves a couple of weeks ago. We had Chris Shipp on from ITV. But when we look at the situation, and, you know, there's been so much said about it since she made that announcement last week. Was it, in hindsight, a comms disaster, or was she right to delay and protect her children? Or was it a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B?
Well, it's not her responsibility. It's the palace's responsibility. The palace's communication
has been awful.
Dog's dinner of it from the get-go. And they've put her in this position. They put her in a very vulnerable position. Mm. Whereas, you know...
Where she was ill-advised in many ways.
Absolutely. And even all the stuff then ever since about, you know, the photoshopped photo and all that sort of stuff. Mm. There's ample opportunities to try and even, you know, privately off the record with a few influential people who might be able to, you know, take the heat out of it. Mm. I just think it's just been a complete mess. And they've put a woman at a very vulnerable situation and a really tough moment, obviously, for herself and her children as well. Just put her into the firing line, and just it's mad to think, because this is the richest family in Britain and has, you know, unlimited power in many ways, that they just don't have a comms team or never mind communications, have an infrastructure around them to protect them when they go through something like this.
You would wonder if the whole mantra of never complain, never explain really works.
It's so dated
in the present day.
It's so dated.
That there, it might be the way in which you get social buy-in by never looking like you're whinging or never sort of being too transparent about things. But there comes a time where when you realise what's been going on for the last 6 weeks now or more, you'd think it's at some point before last Friday, someone should have just said, okay, we need to be a little bit more upfront about the true rationale for this. Now, I know that's easier said than done when you're talking about somebody that's got three young children and needing to manage the nuances of all of that. But like at some point you realise the constitutional role you have in public life in Britain, that you just need to knock things in the head or nip them in the bud by being out there more easily.
Oppositely to that, like, I think you can do that strategy, or you could just have played it completely. If they just stick to the idea of, we're just going to say nothing, we're not going to entertain any of this muck which has been spouted there.
Do you think that was tenable? Because even last week, people were trying to look at freeze frames of her ring and see, was it CGI?
But the releasing of the photograph, which is all doctored and all that sort of crack, like, that's bad. Don't make it worse by throwing this stuff out there. What was the phrase?
Oh, so you think that's part of
the botched transparency? Yeah, that's bad. If you just left it completely quiet, I think that's better than...
When she was talking about experimenting with Photoshop
and stuff. It's mad that it still happened.
I think it was, like, as you said, I totally agree with you in a sense that I think that she was completely... left wide open, and she's already vulnerable enough and isn't feeling well and is already in a difficult situation, and she's a mother trying to look after her kids. And then I just think on top of that, the layer of sort of confusion that was left to just hang there. Now look, we don't know what happened behind closed doors in private, but I think that, like, definitely any comms team would, any sort of cop on should have told her, listen, we're going to have to address this in some way, shape or form. Now, I appreciate that she had said she wanted the kids to come on to the Easter break and be at home and sort of be cocooned at home, obviously, after the news had broken. But like, I still think that she was badly left down, really, by the people who advised her in the last couple of weeks. Stephen Colbert sheepishly kind of coming on to sort of rectify. I don't know if people, you knew, he had sort of said some really, fairly upfront things that were online. He was only saying what was really on the internet, but it was still, you know, desperate situation for her to have had that be put out there, and then for him to have to go, oh, I tell a lot of jokes, you know, lol. And there's been loads of people who've come out and said, oh, oops, Sarah's like, you know, we all made a couple of jokes about it. But she just should have never been put in that situation, particularly when she was so unwell.
I think that there is definite long-term learnings for them, even after the video came out on Friday. And like I said, people were zooming in on certain frames where you could see the famous engagement ring and it was behind her thigh for a couple of frames. And then people were wondering, oh, is the video CGI'd because the ring appears to disappear?
Well, it was shot by BBC Studios, so it was shot by an independent...
Well, people on the internet don't necessarily believe that it's all shot by the BBC. How could they possibly believe what they see on television?
Yeah.
He says, awkwardly shuffling in his seat. There's stuff to be learned that, like, if, the next time something like this happens, you'd presume they'd make a better fist of trying to own the whole thing.
Now, we cannot wrap up this episode without congratulating our dear friend here on running marathon.
Great, yes.
Can I say that I actually was like quite emotional and quite proud of you? Is that really sad?
I appreciate that.
It was lovely. Thank you. I'm so proud of you.
I was sitting in Washington over breakfast with Owen Kelly looking at the race.
Did you have the live tracker?
Like, yeah, to see you get over the line, and was thrilled to bits.
I was so proud of you.
And genuinely, like, you... For someone who was a first time marathon runner, the fact that you told us you didn't hit a wall, which is like amazing.
Wall. I was going too slow for a wall.
Well, that might
you actually weren't going that slow though.
It was intentionally slow because of the injuries and all that sort of stuff. But it worked out grand. Mm. I just fueled very well. Loads of water. There's lots of people like falling around, like collapsing with the heat and.
Well, that must be because if you're training for that in winter and then suddenly you're landing in Rome and what was it like 22 or 23 degrees?
Yeah, it's a terrible. It's a rude awakening in many ways.
I
can't plan for this.
So talk us through, what was it like? You know, what was the whole experience like?
That was amazing. Like, early start in the morning, I was awake from like 5 a.m. and we walked down to Piazza Venezia, which was just in front of the Colosseum where it started and finished. And just, it was, I knew from very early on that I'd just get it done, which is obviously my big concern was when you started with injury, you're like, I don't want to not finish the race. Mm. I knew from very early on, about 2 kilometres in, I was like, this is getting done today, which was great. The fundraiser was great. That ticked over, I think it was 11,200.
Well done.
It was great. Because you're running for nearly 5 hours in the end, which is not a very impressive time.
But the thing is,
like, when you're running for that long and you're exhausted, your mind just completely turns to mush. So by the end of the race, I was actually only, because I put up like an Instagram story to update people who I was doing it just at the end, and I put like music over the end of it. And I listened to the raw one only the other day and I was like, oh my God, I'm in such a trance. I just keep on saying, I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
Do you start going stir crazy then? Like, where if
at that
you're
point,
just,
I
you're
definitely
just so
did.
Task focused for 5 hours that by the end, you've kind of forgotten what your name is.
My mind was complete goo at that point until I finished. And then I got the medal and I started crying. And I was like, this is amazing.
So lovely.
But it was actually the point. So the point of the injury was, this is too much information, but I really needed to pee for the last 2 hours of the marathon. And I obviously couldn't stop because then I wouldn't be able to start again.
Yeah.
So I got to 40 kilometres out of 42 and I went into a porta cabin to pee and I couldn't start again.
Oh no.
And I was like, there was these Americans.
Just for someone who has never done anything as physically exerting as that, like when you say you couldn't start again, like your leg just won't move.
Yeah,
your body's like, move there now.
It can't move. It was just locked. So I just couldn't move it, couldn't get going. There's these Americans who spotted me coming out of the Jacks in Barcelona, who saw my name on my bib and saying, let's go, Richard, let's go. And I was like, this is great. I'll keep moving. I shuffled
around.
You
just need an American in that moment.
And this little girl, I always remember, she had the, you know, the Mario power up, the little mushroom thing. She held up a sign saying power up, tapped the power up, and I gave it a little tap. And I was for whatever reason,
Nudged on
for the last 2 kilometres. It's amazing. Thanks to everybody who like asked about it and everybody who's interested. And
you're already lining up another one now. You're totally addicted.
Dublin October, and I'm having a look at something for next year as well.
Well done.
More fundraisers. Well done, though.
Well, no, I don't think the next ones will just be for fun.
The fundraiser is a lot of work, but like, well done.
Well done, because I know that for the last like 6 weeks or so, where you were like, injuries going to carry over this? Do I know if I'm going to be able to do it? For you to be able to do it and also to stop 2K before the end and still be able to go and do it again is brilliant. So no, it definitely gave me a lift.
Thanks, guys. And now I don't know, anybody who's been sick of me talking about marathons and running will now have at least a couple of months
of rest.
Until I keep banging on.
We're giving it a 3-episode amnesty.
Exactly.
Richard talks about his next marathon.
I'm actually happy not to have to talk about it for a while.
I actually am.
Yeah. Because it does. It becomes this thing like, to be unburdened.
Well, I think it's an amazing thing.
It was amazing. One of the best days of my life. It was amazing. Yeah.
Were there many nuns
cheering people along?
Loads, actually. Loads of priests as well.
We love that.
Young priests and nuns. It was wild to see.
You wouldn't see it
here.
You wouldn't get it in Ireland. Before I let you go, we're about to wrap up. Are you heading back to the Soft Play Centre? What's the plan for the holidays?
Basically, there's going to be cobwebs growing over me and Funky Monkeys before the end of this night.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Rory and all the team in the gallery. And we'll catch you again next week.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.